I go back to sketching the swan. I draw her wings outstretched as she looked when she ran across the surface of the lake. I think about the way her feathers angled into the wind and try to capture that. Behind me, I can hear Jordan complaining to Mrs. Diver about how hard this project is. "Imagine how hard it was for Leo," she tells him. "He was doing this kind of stuff over 500 years ago." I stick my chin into Harry's shirt collar and smell the pine smell. Strange that it should smell so much like trees when Harry seems scared to go outside. I put my sketches of wings aside for a moment and draw a boy's face instead. Two big eyes. It's hard to make them sparkle with an ordinary HB pencil, though. I dot in the freckles on his nose, stretch them out into his cheeks. I dig my pencil hard into the page until the lead snaps. The eyes are too big, and the smile is too wide for Harry, and he doesn't look sick enough. I take a light brown pencil from Sophie's desk and colour in the eyes until they're a chestnut colour. I scribble at the hair until it becomes longer and darker, a little more like Crowe's. I push away from my desk and look at it. What I've drawn isn't anyone. A bit of Harry, a bit of Crowe, and a bit of someone else entirely. Maybe it's my dream boy. Maybe Jack's right when he says I like them both. Matt and Jordan start laughing. I turn around to them quickly. They're leaning forward over their desks, looking at my picture.
"Who's that?" Matt whispers. "Your boyfriend."
I instantly cover it up with my hand, but they're hissing with laughter now, the noise coming through their teeth in breathy gasps. "You sound like a bunch of snakes," I say. That only makes them laugh more. I pull a clean sheet of paper over my picture and go back to planning a wing-based flying machine. I can't concentrate, though. Not now that I know they're watching. I stare at Sophie's page where she's trying to draw an aeroplane. She sketches out a faint kangaroo design running down its side. The boys are still sniggering. I turn my body away from them and stare through the window. The sky is light grey today, like swan feathers. I don't want to be here, not even in an art lesson. I want to be at the lake, running with the swan. I want Harry to come with me. When the bell goes, I walk down the school corridor still thinking about him. People shove into me as they try to get to their lessons, everyone in such a hurry. It's not like the hospital corridors. These corridors are crammed with lockers and school bags and laughter, smells of wet jumpers and sweat. At the corner of the corridor, Mr. Simmons, the IT teacher, is waiting for us. I imagine Harry standing there also, waiting for me like how he waited near Dad's ward. In IT, I forget about spreadsheets and what we're meant to be doing. I wait until Mr. Simmons is busy helping someone, then open Internet Explorer. I can flick back to my spreadsheet document if Mr. Simmons comes close. It's not as if I'm the only one doing it. Most of the others are checking their emails, and the boys behind me are searching for dodgy sites. I hear them now whispering as they click onto something new. I type, "How to make a winged flying machine," into the search engine. There are over 14 million results. The first things that come up are about making model aeroplanes. I click on a related search that says, "Make your own wings." These results are more practical, giving me instructions and patterns. I click on a link that shows how someone made huge angel wings using two bags of turkey feathers and then wore them to a party. But there is nothing about swan wings, and nothing about how to turn stuffed swan wings into a moving model about flight. I keep clicking. On the ninth page, I find something different. The picture that comes up is of a pencil-sketched man holding his arms out straight. Behind him, attached to his arms and chest, with what looks like some sort of harness, are huge white wings. Swan wings. They have to be. They're too big to be anything else. It looks like they're coming right out of his back. I lean close to the computer screen to see. The picture looks ancient and faint, as if it were drawn long before the internet existed. It looks like something Da Vinci could have drawn himself. I scroll down. Below the picture is a list of materials, and below that, instructions. 1. Acquire the wings of a large bird. 2. Bend stainless steel wire into shapes that follow the contours of the wings. 3. Make 20 small incisions in the skin along the wing bones. The instructions get more complicated as I read through. I squint at the diagrams. They seem to show that, once finished, these wings would be able to twist and flap, just like a real bird's. Leather straps lead out from a harness and fasten the wearer's arms to the wings so that he can turn them just by moving his body. I keep scrolling through the pages of instructions. They look so hard, too hard. But I have Grandad's stuffed swan, and Grandad has loads of weird things in his barn that might help. Perhaps it is possible. I save this link. I minimize the browser and go back to my spreadsheet. When it comes to printing what I've done, I print these instructions too. Chapter 35. On Saturday, Mum drops me at the hospital, then drives off to do the shopping. "I'll meet you at Dad's ward later," she says. "Don't you dare be late." I wait until I see Mum's car pull out onto the ring road before I thread my way through the car park to the fence. I walk quickly through the trees. I'm certain the swan must have flown away by now. But she's still there, still alone too. I drop my bag and go right up to the water's edge. The swan keeps watching me, waiting for me. I've told Mum I want to sketch her wings again, but that's not the only reason I'm here. I do up my laces. I start to jog and wait for her to follow. It's not long before I hear her feet slapping on the water behind. This time, I try something different. I slow down. I glance at her and see that she's slowing too. I speed up. She does the same, rising onto the water's surface and beating her wings. I stop abruptly. She does too. She sticks her feet out in front of her like brakes, making water shoot up around her, then waits for my next move. She's doing exactly what I do. Exactly. I turn to her, suddenly angry, suddenly fed up with all the weirdness. "Stop following me!" I yell. I run towards the water, waving my arms about. "Why won't you just fly?" She flinches, but doesn't move back. She stares at me blankly, looking at me first from one side and then turning her head and looking from the other. She blinks. I pick up a stone from near my feet and skim it across the water. I don't know why I do it. I suppose I just want her to react like a normal bird. But she doesn't move away, and the stone sinks before it reaches her. She waits a moment, then swims towards me. She steps onto the bank, totally unafraid. Her head is low and submissive, so I walk right up to her. It's as if she wants me to touch her. I hold out my hand then, rest it against her head. She doesn't move back. I take a deep breath and force my shoulders to relax. "Why aren't you scared?" I say, calmer now. I stroke her neck, feeling her thin body beneath the feathers. She's unbelievably soft. So breakable. I could wrap my hands around her neck and squeeze. She'd let me. She shuts her eyes and I touch the tiny yellowish feathers around them. I sigh out, sit down opposite her. "You're just stupid, aren't you? A head case of a swan. Maybe I should tell someone to stick you in a zoo." I'm suddenly exhausted, frustrated by trying to work her out. There's a flicker of morning sunlight dancing across my face. It's making me sleepy. I lean up against the tree stump and look across the lake, absently counting the birds. 3 mallards, 2 tufted ducks, 4 coots. After a while, the swan inches back into the water. She digs her beak into the wall of the bank and starts feeding. Just a normal bird. The day gets brighter. Soon the sun has burst through the clouds and is bouncing onto the lake. It makes the water shimmer, makes it hard to watch. I shut my eyes, enjoying the warmth against my skin. It feels like it's the first bit of sun we've had since summer. It feels special. I concentrate on the warmth, trying not to think about Dad and the hospital and everything bad. The insides of my eyelids are pink from the bright light. I try to make my body as still as the tree stump I'm leaning against. And soon, I feel my thoughts drifting away. Chapter 36. I feel myself sinking. It's as if I'm falling down into the earth, being pulled towards the ground. The wind is whooshing at my ears. Then the images come. Everything flutters at first. There are so many pictures, all flashing into my brain so quickly. I try to grasp at them. And slowly, I begin to see. There's sky, clouds, a whir of wings. Swans are all around me. I look down and see the whole world stretched out below me. I'm flying. There's a smudge of a lake ahead. Swans start murmuring as we get closer. There's a wind pushing from behind, pushing me forwards. It happens so quickly. The swan in front twists backwards. He looks around as he starts to fall, his wings useless and still. He screeches. I turn, try to find a different route. The wind is too strong. Another bird screams. Suddenly I see them. There are two lines across the sky, blocking our path. I feel the flock splitting, losing formation, scattering. I fly straight at the sun and hope. I hear a sharp smack as another bird hits the lines. I keep beating. I twist my body, try to get a grip on the wind. The birds flying with me begin to drop away, but I can't stop. Not yet. Not until I'm far away. I look down at the land as I go. And far, far below, there are two people. A big one and a small one. A cold gust whips around me as I realise it's me down there. Me and Dad. We're on a path at the edge of a lake, and we're waving our arms madly, yelling out. It's what we were doing that first day. The day when the swans arrived. Chapter 37. My eyes snap open. The swan is still drifting on the lake in front of me, still digging her beak into the bank and feeding. She's not looking at me at all, but it was her story I was dreaming. I'm sure of it. I crawl towards her. Her head comes up as she checks where I am, then goes down again to feed. She drifts further away. She couldn't look more like an ordinary bird if she tried. I rub my eyes, check the time on my watch. It's still early. I've only been asleep for about 10 minutes, but already the sun's disappeared from a cloud, making the lake look so much darker. I glance back at the swan, but she's floating further away, only intent on eating. I don't want to sketch her. Not now. I just want to talk to Harry. I get to his room in a daze. It still feels like I'm half asleep, still flying high above the reserve. The same nurse lets me in. "He looks worse than he is," she tells me carefully. Harry's in bed, propped up so he can see out of the window. The skin around his eyes looks grey and thin and makes his cheekbones stand out. I hover in the doorway. He squints as he focuses on me, and I can see he's not totally with it. I sit on the edge of his bed, right up close. "I was watching," he says. I smile. I'm glad. I reach for the glass of water on his bedside table and put it into his hands. "You don't look so good today." He manages a grimace. "More chemo." He blinks slowly, takes a sip. He pushes the glass back into my hand. "Help me sit up." He reaches out to me. I look at his smooth, pale hands, his long fingers. I lean towards him and he grabs me around my shoulders. Carefully, I put my hands around his chest. My face is near his neck. He doesn't smell ill. He smells like trees and life. I wonder if he can feel my breath on his skin. He pushes down on my shoulders, his fingers cold through my shirt, pushes himself up. He shuffles back against the pillows. I almost want to stay like that a moment longer, buried into his body. But I don't. Both of us look away as I take my arms back.
Now, he says once he's settled, what's been going on?
He nods towards the window, really wanting to know. I tell him how the swan was following my movements exactly. I tell him how I fell asleep and dreamt about her flock flying into the lines. I watch his face as he listens. He doesn't laugh or look doubtful. Even if he doesn't believe me, he's making a good effort of pretending to. He yawns slowly.
Maybe you should find her flock, he says. Maybe if she had her flock, she'd fly.
It's a good thought, but I start laughing all the same. How would I get a swan to a flock? I say, taxi. He smiles slightly.
Here, it is kind of stupid, I guess.
I look back out of the window. I can still see her there, floating alone. I'm probably just overreacting, I tell Harry. Whooper swans won't migrate back to Iceland for at least another 3 months, so there's time. Time for her to start flying again. Time for her flock to find her. I don't know why I'm so worried about her, really. When I look back at Harry, his eyes are shut. He looks so much more relaxed now that he's slipping into sleep. His hair is definitely getting thinner. I can see patches of skin on his head, and there are gingery strands all over his duvet. His breathing becomes heavier as I watch. I move my hand across the bed and touch his fingers. They're still so cold, like Dad's hand in the ambulance. I think about holding Harry's hand in mine, making him warm again. I wait there for a little while, wondering if he'll wake up. When he doesn't, I write him a note on the back of a flyer for the hospital cafe. Keep watching her. Text me if anything changes. Isla. I leave my number at the bottom. I don't know whether to write an X after my name. I look at his white, pale skin, his fluttering eyelids covering up those bright eyes underneath. He looks like one of those stone angels you find in churches sometimes. I don't know why, but I lean forward and brush a bit of hair from his cheek. His skin twitches. I move my hand away instantly. I don't know what I'd do if he woke up and found me touching his face. I hold my breath, waiting. But he doesn't move again. He's already too deep in sleep to even notice. Chapter 38. Mum and Jack are waiting on the chairs outside Dad's ward. As I look at their faces, my stomach sinks. What's happened? Mum reaches for my hand.
His heartbeat has sped up again, she says. They're bringing his operation forward.
Is he okay?
Mum nods. Go in and see him, babe. Jack and I will wait here.
I go in alone. Dad's eyes are closed and he's really still. I can't stop swallowing as I watch him. After a moment, I hold my hand out, place it down on his chest. I spread my fingers wide to try and feel. And there, just faintly, is a heartbeat. That quick, unsteady beat is the best feeling in the world. I breathe out. I keep my hand there, resting on his chest. I don't want to pull it away. I stay really still, just feeling the soft thuds, the way Dad's skin seems to quiver beneath my fingers. Lying down with his eyes closed, Dad looks younger than he normally does. I try to pass a thought to Dad, a kind of prayer to make him better. His eyelids flicker as if he's heard me. I sit on the edge of the chair beside his bed and wait. When his eyes open properly, I lean over him. His mouth twitches into a smile as he focuses on me.
How's that swan?
He murmurs, breathless again.
Still there?
I nod. She won't fly.
No flock, either.
Not yet, he frowns. Don't worry, I say. They're still ages before they migrate.
I suppose.
But he keeps frowning. I lean closer to him. She'll fly, I tell him. Any day now. And Dad's mouth twitches to a smile again. Chapter 39. It's takeaway again. And a trip to Grandad's. Mum gets him the only English meal on the menu. Omelette and chips.
I don't know why I'm even bothering, she says as she drives. It's not as if he'll appreciate our visit.
I lean forward to rest my head on the back of her seat. But I want to go, I say. Jack grunts and sticks his feet up on the dash.
Just because you do doesn't mean we all do.
Mum leans across to slap his feet away.
He's your granddad, Jack.
But it's Saturday night.
He closes his hand into a fist and rests it against the window. Granddad's expecting us this time, and he's got plates already laid out on the table.
All right, Kath,
he says, taking the bags from her. Mum raises her eyebrows in surprise and follows him to the table.
Graham's operation is on Monday now, she says quietly. They've brought it forward. You know he'd appreciate a visit.
Grandad keeps his head down, focusing on taking all the containers out of the bag.
So, the ticker is getting quicker, he says.
His eyes dart over to me and Jack, and then he starts laughing at his joke. Mum's lips tense into a thin line. She takes the containers from the middle of the table and thumps them onto our plates.
Glad you find your son's illness funny,
she mutters. Jack slops his curry onto his plate and starts shoveling it in. I chase an onion strand around. I'm not hungry. I just want to eat quickly so I can be out in the barn. Grandad looks at us again before he leans towards Mum.
Those kids are petrified,
he says quietly.
You don't need to worry them unnecessarily about Graham.
And what would you do? Not tell them anything?
Mum's eyes bore into Grandad's. He looks down immediately. Neither of them notices as Jack slopes off to the couch. I suck up a long, thin strand of spinach and think about joining him. I rub my lips together, feeling the grease there. Mum and Grandad start talking about what happened to Nan for the 50 billionth time.
It wasn't Graham's fault that she died in hospital,
Mum says, raising her voice a little. I put my knife and fork neatly together on the plate, drag my chair out quietly, and slip away from the table. I walk to the barn, sticking my hands deep into my coat pockets. The pages I printed out in IT are there, folded up neatly. I pull back the bolt, flick the light, and walk straight to the stuffed swan. A door slams somewhere. I don't know whether it's to do with the argument or the wind. I listen to hear if anyone's coming looking for me, but it's quiet again immediately after. I touch the glass surrounding the swan, make a line through the dust as I trace its wings. It would be brilliant to have wings, to be able to fly away whenever you needed to. Birds have it easy like that. I take the instructions out of my pocket. I glance over the long equipment list. One large bird, leather, strong rope, buckles and belts, knife, stiff thread. I look at the diagrams that show how to cut the wings, how to thread wire through them and make them move. Then I look at the diagrams that show how to make the leather harness in the middle. It looks so complicated. If Dad were here, he'd be able to do it so easily. I think of him lying in his bed, all alone and waiting, with us all here at Grandad's. I go looking for equipment. I find a black plastic box with a whole lot of knives and clamps and clipper things inside. It must be stuff Grandad used in his vet practice. I pick up the box and go back to the swan cabinet. I lay it face down against the concrete. There are small metal fasteners attaching the backing to the frame. I use pliers to get them loose, then grip the backing and pull. It's heavier than I thought because the stuffed swan is attached to it, but I manage to lift it out. I turn it over, put it on the floor and look down at the huge white bird at my feet. It's so massive, stretched out like that. I run my hands over its spread wings. They're so soft, but springy and tough too, and so wide, like fans. I remember what Dad said about swan's wings catching souls and carrying them to heaven, and I think I can understand why people thought that. If anything could carry something precious, they could. I shudder suddenly, remembering the way the swans were hovering when Dad fell down in that field. Were they waiting for him then? Waiting for his soul? I take a small sharp knife and slit the tight loops of string that fasten the swan to the backing. The wings flop backwards when I've finished, bigger than ever. I smooth them out then, run my hands down to the place where the wings join the body. It's firm there, as if there are still muscles pressed up against the feathers. I think about the knife hacking through them all, ripping them apart. I sit back on my heels. I don't know if I can do this. It would be like chopping up a bird, destroying something beautiful. There's a thud, then footsteps, thumping heavily towards me on the path. I freeze, the knife still in my hand. I don't know why I should feel guilty about what I'm doing, but I do. Should I try to hide it? I stand and walk towards the door. Jack comes storming in before I get there. He doesn't even look at me, just kicks a cardboard box so it goes skidding across the concrete.
Bloody mum!
Why, what's she done? He boots a pile of junk, sending a plastic plant pot into a corner.
Can't she just accept the fact that Grandad's not going to visit Dad? She's driving me nuts!
He sends another plant pot in the same direction as the first.
Why are you in here anyway?
He turns around, then flinches when he sees me.
What are you doing with that?
He's looking at my hand, looking at the knife that I'd forgotten to leave with the swan. His eyes flick back to my face. He's staring at me as if I'm some sort of psychopath. Nothing, I say. But he doesn't believe me. He walks towards me, grabs my arms, turns them over. I'm not trying to hurt myself, don't be stupid. His eyes narrow. I wrench my arms away from him, put the knife back in my coat pocket. Jack's eyes flick to where I've come from in the barn.
Show me,
he demands. I don't move for a moment, but he steps up closer and says firmly,
show me what you're doing.
Chapter 40. I don't argue with him. What would be the point? Besides, perhaps he can help me understand some of the complicated instructions.
I've seen this thing before,
he says when I take him to the swan.
I remember it from when we were young.
He lifts the swan away from the backing and the wings hang down over his arms.
Why have you taken it out of its case?
I show him the instructions. He reads them quickly, his eyes squinting at the small text. He looks back at the swan, brushes his fingers against the section where the wing joins the body.
You're going to cut it up? Why?
I shrug. Just a project.
You're crazy.
He laughs suddenly.
And what's Grandad going to think?
His expression changes as he imagines it, and he holds out his hand towards me.
Give me the knife.
Why? I close my fingers over it. He sticks his hands back on the wings.
I'll do it.
He's nodding slightly, full of energy. I can imagine the way he'll hack through the bird in his current mental state. He just wants to destroy something. I put the knife into my pocket. I'll do it myself.
I bet you won't.
His eyes dart to my face.
You've probably been sitting here for ages wondering if it's the right thing to do. I can just imagine it. You wouldn't want to chop up a bird in a million years, even when it's stuffed. Give me the knife.
He tries to get his hand into my pocket. I turn away from him quickly. I can do it, I say. He makes another lunge at me, but I step back, avoiding him.
I thought you wanted my help, he says.
Not when you're like this. He holds out his hand.
Come on, Isla, he says, his tone more reasonable now. You know you won't really do it. You're too much like Dad to chop this thing up. You're too soft.
I will.
Show me then.
He smiles a small, tight smile as he watches me. He stands and scuffs his shoe against one of the wings. I know he's only angry because of what he's heard in the house, but it makes my fingers tense around the knife all the same. I'll do it, I say. I crouch, with the knife hovering above the bird's right shoulder. I bring it down until it touches the feathers. I press gently, testing to see how hard I need to push. Jack kneels down too.
Go on, he whispers. What's all this for, anyway? Your little boyfriend in hospital?
Something snaps inside me then.
I turn from the swan to push him away. I hold the knife up towards him. "Just get lost," I say. "Go and be angry somewhere else." Jack's sneer drops immediately. He holds his hands up in defence.
"Hey, calm down," he mutters. "I was only trying to help."
"You're not helping," I say. "You're just making everything worse." I glare at him. I keep the knife clenched in my fist until he gets up from the floor. Jack takes a couple of steps away, looking at me like I'm mental. I don't care. He can think whatever he wants as far as I'm concerned. I turn back to the swan, wrap both of my hands around the knife, and thrust it down. There's a ripping sound as it goes in. I grip my teeth and push harder. I push until the blade clinks against the floor on the other side. Then I hack down, pulling the knife in jerky movements to make it go through all the stuffing. I shut my eyes so I don't have to think about it too much. I keep going until the whole wing is chopped off. Only then do I open my eyes. There are chunks of stuffing everywhere, all over the wings and floor, all over me too. The separated wing reminds me of the one in the reserve that the fox didn't eat. It doesn't smell as bad, but it still makes me feel slightly sick. I wipe the blade on my trousers to get rid of all the bits of stuffing. Then I drag the swan's body back towards me and get started on the other wing. I try to pretend it's just a pillow I'm cutting into, not a shoulder, not something that used to be alive. When I look up again, Jack's gone. I sit back, focus on the strands of cobwebs linking the rafters and the roof. I take one deep breath, then another, then rest my head on my knees. The knife clatters as it drops to the floor, and I can feel tears pricking my eyes. I hug my knees to my face and let them come. Chapter 41. The barn gets colder. A wind starts battering at its metal sides. The fluorescent light above me flickers. After a while, I crawl forwards on my hands and knees through the bits of stuffing. I pile the two wings on top of each other and put them to one side. Then make myself lift the body. It feels so long and thin. It's much lighter without its wings, like lifting cotton wool. I don't know where to put it, so I lay it on the old operating table. I stretch it out like a corpse and turn its face away from me. I sit next to the wings and pick up the instructions. A part of me doesn't want to keep going. Knows Jack's right when he says I can't do it. But the other part of me is stubborn and can't leave the wings like this, all chopped up and useless. It feels wrong somehow, a waste. I ignore the really complicated instructions about how to make the leather harness and instead follow the ones that tell me how to make a series of slits along the wings. I dig the knife in quickly and carefully, then get up and start sifting through the boxes, looking for wire to thread through. I hear the barn door open again. Grandad steps in cautiously, tries a smile. It's obviously fake, put on to pretend that everything's okay now between him and Mum.
"Your Mum's asking if you want to go home," he says.
I wonder if he can tell I've been crying. He steps towards me, and I see his eyes widen as he clocks the swan's body on the operating table. He frowns as he sees the wings, too. He looks at me a little like Jack did, as if he thinks I'm going mad. I brace myself as he comes closer, ready for him to be angry because I chopped up something that reminds him of Nan. I wait for his face to go red and scary looking. Suddenly, I wish Jack had stayed. I try to explain about making a model for my art project, and he stops and looks down at the wings, his face not frowning anymore. His joints click as he kneels.
"All this effort for a school project?"
"And I want to give it to Dad too," I say, "when I finished." I hand him the instructions. I don't go on and tell him how I'm hoping, stupidly, that these wings will make Dad feel better, how I want them to lift his spirits. I look up at the light, watch the dust particles floating in front of it. When I look back at Grandad, I have tiny stars dancing before my eyes.
He takes his glasses out of his pocket so he can read the instructions better. Then he lifts one of the wings, making a noise in his throat that sounds like a mixture of a laugh and a cough.
"I never imagined you'd want Swanson so you could chop him up,"
he mutters.
"He's been sitting here for years."
I tense, still waiting for him to be angry. But instead, there's that small cough-like chuckle again. He seems kind of amused. He turns back to the wing and examines the slits I've made there.
"Not bad,"
he says.
"It wouldn't take much to stitch all that up. A few more cuts here."
I crouch down next to him. "You're not mad," I say, "that I chopped it up." He peers at me over his glasses, his eyes wider than I've ever seen them.
"Why would I be?"
His voice is low and gravelly.
"Beth wondered what to do with this bird for years."
He picks up the instructions again, reads them slowly.
"I've got most of that equipment. Even got an old climbing harness of your father's somewhere around here. We could use that instead of making our own."
He peers at the diagram that shows how to attach strips of leather to the wings and wrap them around the wearer's body.
"It's for you to wear, yes?"
I shrug. "I suppose."
"Your father's old climbing harness would fit then."
The wrinkles in his forehead disappear for a moment as he smiles at me. He looks so much like Dad then that I can't help gasping. He gets up slowly and shuffles back to the stuff around the operating table. He finds a box that has loads of useful stuff, including the strong thread he used for stitching animals. He finds the harness that Dad used to use for rock climbing and turns it over, checking for damage.
"Your dad used to climb everything,"
he explains.
"Even when he was younger, he was a bit of a daredevil, a bit of a fool."
He gives it to me to hold. I pull at the straps. It's smaller than the harnesses Dad uses now to chop branches down for work, and it would fit me perfectly.
"We just need to run some more material and straps up the back so we can fasten it around your chest,"
Grandad murmurs, turning it to show me.
"And attach it to the wings, of course."
He's nodding quickly as he looks at it, his expression no longer like the grumpy old man everyone argues with. So I let him help. It's weird, but he seems to change a bit as he does. He smiles more and his voice gets softer. For a moment, I can almost pretend that it's Dad here with me. His eyes squint as he chooses a needle and tries to thread it. "I'll help," I say, and do it for him. Then he begins to stitch. He works quickly and carefully, not damaging the structure of the swan's wings at all.
"Did you know," he murmurs, "that the bones in a swan's wing are pretty much the same as the bones in a human arm? Isn't that amazing? A few people even argue that our bodies have descended from birds."
By the time he asks me for the next instruction, there's a grin on his face. Chapter 42. When Mum gets there, Grandad is still stitching thread through the wings. Grandad doesn't turn to acknowledge her, and she doesn't say anything to him either. Instead, she finds an old coat, spreads it next to me and sits down. Her eyes slowly take in the whole big wingspan of the swan.
"Jack said you were making something for school,"
she says. "And for Dad." She nods.
"They're beautiful."
It's not long before Jack comes in too. His eyes widen when he sees what we've done.
"You cut them off," he says. "Or was it Grandad who did it?"
He smirks at me, then sprawls out on the other side of Grandad and starts fiddling with the box of surgical equipment. I wait for Mum to tell me it's time to go, but she just watches quietly. So I help Grandad with the climbing harness, holding it still for him to sew the wings to. His stitches are so small and neat, I can hardly see them. "You're good at that," I say.
"Just practice."
His hands aren't even shaking. Now that he's helping me with this, he seems like a different person. Mum's noticed too, I'm sure. After a while, Jack starts sighing and looking at his watch.
They'll all be waiting for me, he says. Can we go now?
Mum leans on my shoulder as she pushes herself up. Come on, Isla, it's almost 9. Grandad stops threading the needle, a flash of frustration across his face. I want to carry on, I say, suddenly having an idea. I want this ready for Dad to see before his operation. Mum fiddles with her rings as she thinks.
I could drop her back at the house, says Grandad. Or even drop her straight at the hospital tomorrow morning.
I look quickly at Grandad. We all do. It's so unlike him to suggest something helpful. For a moment or two, it doesn't look like Mum knows what to say. She raises her eyebrow at me. It's up to you, babe. I nod, thinking of Dad, wanting to try anything right now to make him feel better. Even if it is something as crazy as showing a flying machine I made. I want to finish this. And I do. We're so close to the end, it seems crazy to stop. Even if it does mean that I have to stay at Grandad's again. Mum brushes her fingers through my hair as she goes. Be good. But Grandad and I don't sleep. We keep going for hours, turning the wings into a flying model that gradually starts to move. At some stage, Grandad fetches a lamp from another part of the barn and puts it near to us for more light. He gets old, scratchy blankets too, and we wrap them around our shoulders. The dust on them makes my throat itch. After a while, the small letters on the instruction sheet blur before my eyes. I bury my head inside the blankets and just watch Grandad work. He looks so focused, so completely concentrated on getting it right. I wonder if he was like this as a vet. Perhaps this focus and skill is why he thought he could care for Nan at home, why he was so angry when Dad took her to the hospital. I'm pretty much asleep by the time Grandad leans away from what we've made and notices me.
Come on,
he says.
Let's go inside and get a drink.
The wind has died down when we get out of the barn. The only sound is our feet, crunching against the dirt path. I screw up my eyes when we get into the lit kitchen and look down at the lino floor until they've adjusted. We sit on the couch, sipping tea, sweet and hot. Grandad looks tired, but not exhausted. There's a sparkle in his eyes. But I feel myself sinking down and the cup being taken from my hands. My head drops back into the cushions, springs and feathers beneath me. And I dream of Dad. Swans are carrying him up into the sky, singing the most beautiful song as they go. It's a swan song to take him higher. Chapter 43. A beeping sound goes off near my ear, and I wake with a start. The room is silver grey, and Grandad isn't next to me anymore. There's just a cold cup of tea on the carpet and my phone. I lean over and grab it. The message is from a number I don't recognise. Swan just tried to fly again, but no luck. Saw a flock flying in the distance, but they didn't land. Harry. P.S. Wish you were here. I read it 3 times. Then I check the time. 6:47 a.m. He's up early. I lie there looking around at Grandad's shabby lounge room and wonder what to text back. I stretch my arms above my head. My body aches as if I've been running for hours. I sit up and glance over to the kitchen. The house is silent and still and empty. I get up and open the back door. There's a robin's clear, loud voice. I scan the shadowy fields for swans, stand on my tiptoes and try to see the lake. I reply to Harry. I'll see you later. I've got a surprise for you. I stick the phone in my pocket and walk. I yawn in crisp morning air and feel the dampness of dawn on my cheeks. Grandad is searching through a pile of boxes, but looks up when he hears me.
I've finished it. He says, just now.
Why didn't you wake me? A part of me feels angry. I wanted to make the flying model. It's my project, after all. But then I see the swan's wings stretched out across the concrete, with the climbing harness in between them. And I'm glad Grandad's done it. There are wires connecting different parts of the harness to the feathers. There are Velcro loops running down the middle of each wing for my arms to be attached, and gardening gloves towards the wingtips for my hands to go in. The model looks beautiful and complicated, and exactly like the picture. I pick up the crumpled instructions and check how Grandad's made it.
I don't know where you found those instructions,
Grandad says slowly.
But they're good. Whatever they say to do just works.
I kneel down to the model. I run my fingers up the thick leather strips that lead up from the back of the harness and see how securely they are attached to the wings. This is amazing, I say. Better than I could have done. This makes Grandad chuckle. He draws his shoulders back and looks proud of himself. It's the same sort of movement that a swan makes when it resettles its feathers.
Let's see if they work, he says.
He lifts the wings up carefully, holding them flat. They look absolutely massive. Are they heavy? I ask. Grandad shakes his head.
Not really. Surprising, eh? But then, as well as the bones being hollow, it's only stuffing inside this thing.
I turn my back to Grandad and he helps me to step into the climbing harness. I tighten it around my hips. Already I can feel the wings pulling me backwards.
It'll be better in a minute, Grandad
says.
Hold your arms out straight.
I do, and he fastens my outstretched arms to the wings by wrapping the Velcro straps tightly around them. Then he passes a leather strap that looks like an old belt around my chest, attaching me to the material running down my back. I breathe in as he tightens another leather strap around my stomach. He closes the final bit of Velcro, securing my hands inside the gardening gloves.
There,
he murmurs.
Nice and snug.
I can see my shadow on the far wall, my tiny-looking body with the huge wings spread out behind me. I look like some sort of winged superhero. Bird girl. I try moving my fingers one by one. I look down the wings, get a little buzz of excitement when I see the wires leading out from the gloves moving too. I follow the wires with my eyes and notice the primary flight feathers parting and twisting with my movements. I roll my shoulders and feel the feathers ruffle out behind me. It's exactly the way a real bird would move its feathers.
Magic,
Grandad breathes. The feathers are so close to me that I can smell their dust and stuffing. The wings press against my back as if I'm wearing a big backpack. I arch my back and watch my shadow on the wall. The wings change shape slightly with each movement I make.
Try folding them inwards,
Grandad says. He checks the instructions.
Bend your elbows and bring your fists towards you.
I try it. At first, the wings seem too stiff to move, but I pull on them a little harder and they fold inwards obediently.
Now try to cross your arms over your chest.
I slide my right arm over my left and the wings settle around me. Grandad presses his hands across his mouth, shaking his head gently. It's what Dad does when he's really impressed with something.
Just like a proper bird, he murmurs again. I've never seen anything like it.
I can't do anything but nod. I'm still blown away by it all myself. Grandad and I have made an amazing wing model. A proper flying machine, just like Da Vinci's. Let's take them to the hospital, I say. Chapter 44. You can park over there. Grandad's hands tighten on the wheel. He doesn't want to do it, but I'm making him. He keeps the car running and waits for me to get out. I lean across and turn the keys in the ignition. Will you come in? Show Dad with me. Grandad breathes out slowly, then gets out of the car. He doesn't say anything as we walk across the car park towards the hospital entrance. His eyes are darting around, though, and he's clasping his hands tightly together.
I hold the wing model folded up in a tight bundle, close to my chest. It's still early, not long after 8. Mum won't be here yet. We've arranged to meet outside Dad's ward at 9. I hug the wings tighter as I realise how cold it is. Grandad bumps into me as an ambulance screams past, its lights flashing bright in the misty morning. He hesitates as we go through the entrance hall.
"Are you sure they'll let me in?"
he asks. I shrug. "We can wait in the cafe until they do." He pauses near the plastic palm trees, and I think he's going to turn round and go home right then. "Let's just try," I say. "Think of Dad's face when he sees what we've made." He keeps following me to the lifts. I hold the doors open until he gets in after me. There's a small boy and his mum already in there, and they keep giving me weird looks. I'm sure the boy thinks I'm carrying a real bird. It's actually quite difficult to carry the wing model. I have to put my arms underneath to support it and rest my chin on top. I suppose if you couldn't see the harness underneath it, it would look like I was hugging a swan. Grandad walks really slowly all the way to Dad's ward. There's a cleaner up ahead, mopping down the floors, and Grandad turns away from the disinfectant smell. I see how hard this is for him, how much he doesn't want to be here. When we get to the entrance, he stops and folds his arms over his chest.
"Why don't you just check that it's okay first?"
he mumbles. I go in and ask the nurse. 9 is when visiting hours begin," she says, eyeing the wing model warily. "I'll let you in then." When I come back to the corridor, Grandad is gone. I run back the way we've come, but can't find him anywhere. The lifts are all full, so I hold the banister tightly with one hand and keep my other around the wing model as they race down the stairs. I turn sideways at the bottom to get past someone in a wheelchair. Grandad's not waiting in the cafe or near the plastic trees. I go through the sliding doors and into the car park. He's there, his hand on the car door. He waves when I see him.
"Your dad will love those wings,"
he calls out to me. Then he gets into his car. I'm so shocked that he's leaving like this. I just stand in the entrance, right in the way of everyone trying to get in, and stare after his car. I can feel the anger in my throat and chest, making everything tight. I clutch the wing model. I understand now why Mum's always so mad at him. I turn quickly. I take the lift to Harry's room. It's not a conscious decision, not really. It's just where my feet seem to lead me. There's a lady coming out of the ward as I get there, and she holds the door for me. The ward is quiet and sleepy. There aren't even any nurses on the front desk. Harry's door is closed. I peer in through the glass section of it and see that he's awake. He's sitting up in bed, turned away from me. He's looking out the window through a gap in his curtains. I glance down the corridor to check for nurses. Then I try to put on the harness. It's hard without Grandad there to help, and I can't tighten anything properly. I unfold the wings a little so I can get my arms into the loops and fasten the Velcro straps with my teeth. I press my legs against Harry's door until it opens. I sidle into his room sideways. Then I uncross my arms and the wings spread out behind me. Harry turns. His mouth opens a little as he focuses on me, and his eyes go wide as saucers. "Isla?" he whispers. I almost laugh at the way he looks so totally gobsmacked. "Who were you expecting?" I take a step towards him, the wings bouncing lightly around me. It's hard to keep balanced with them outstretched like this, hard to walk straight. They're so huge. My left wing brushes against the TV on the wall. I try to pull it inwards. Everything feels stiff and disjointed, but I'm beginning to get the hang of it. It's actually easier than I thought. Harry raises his hand as if he wants to touch the feathers. I stand close to the bed and let him. His face is as pale as his pillowcase. "It looks like you've seen a ghost," I say, trying to joke. He doesn't smile back. "I thought I had," he says, "with the light from the corridor shining in behind you. You look like an angel."
I laugh at him properly then. Don't be stupid. But he's completely serious. He's quiet for a bit, just taking it all in. He strokes his fingers against the wings.
Where did you get these? He asks. What are they for?
I explain about my art project and flying machines.